Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome, Episode 2. Adapted for radio and performed by Jeremy Nicholas.
At Weybridge, the Wey, the Bourne, and the Basingstoke Canal all enter the Thames together. The lock is just opposite the town, and the first thing that we saw when we came in view of it was George's blazer on one of the lock gates. Closer inspection showing that George is inside it. Montmorency set up a furious barking. I shrieked, Harris roared, George waved his hat and yelled back. The lockkeeper rushed out with a drag, under the impression that somebody had fallen into the lock, and appeared annoyed at finding that no one had. George had a rather curious oilskin-covered parcel in his hand. It was round and flat at one end, with a long straight handle sticking out of it. What's that, said Harris. A frying pan? No, said George, they're all that rains this season. Everybody's got them up the river. It's a banjo. Oh, I never knew you played the banjo, cried Harris and I in one breath. Well, not exactly, replied George, but it's very easy, they tell me. And I've got the instruction book. We made George work now we'd got him. He didn't want to work, of course. That goes without saying. He did suggest that perhaps it would be better for him to stop in the boat and get tea ready while Harris and I towed, because getting tea was such a worrying work, and Harris and I looked tired. The only reply we made to this, however, was to pass him over the tow line. We pulled up to the point, Picnic Point, it's called, and thought, now we could have supper. But George said, no, we'd better get the canvas up first, before it got quite dark and while we could still see what we were doing. Then he said all our work would be done, and we could sit down to eat with an easy mind. It would take quite 10 minutes, we thought. That was an underestimate. We took up the hoops and began to drop them into the sockets placed for them. You would not imagine this to be dangerous work, but looking back now, the wonder to me is that any of us are alive to tell the tale. They had hinges in the middle, these hoops, and when we were not looking, they nipped us in delicate parts of the body. And while we were wrestling with one side of the hoop and endeavouring to persuade it to do its duty, the other side would come behind us in a cowardly manner and hit us over the head. We got them fixed at last, and then all that was to be done was to arrange the covering over them. It took us half an hour's hard labour after that before it was properly up, and then we cleared the decks and got out supper. We put the kettle on to boil, up in the nose of the boat, and went down to the stern and pretended to take no notice of it, but set to work to get the other things out. That's the only way to get a kettle to boil up the river. If it sees that you are waiting for it and are anxious, it'll never even sing. You have to go away and begin your meal as if you weren't going to have any tea at all. You mustn't even look round at it. It's a good plan, too, if you're in a great hurry, to talk very loudly to each other about how you don't need any tea, and are not going to have any. You get near the kettle, so that it can overhear you, and then you shout out, I don't want any tea, do you, George? To which George shouts back, oh, no, we'll have lemonade instead. Tea's so indigestible. Upon which the kettle boils over and puts the stove out. We adopted this harmless bit of trickery, and the result was that by the time everything else was ready, the tea was waiting. Then we lit the lantern and squatted down to supper. We wanted that supper. For 5 and 30 minutes, not a sound was heard throughout the length and breadth of that boat, save the clank of cutlery and crockery and the steady grinding of four sets of molars. At the end of 5 and 30 minutes, Harry said, ah. And 5 minutes afterwards, George said, ah. And 3 minutes later than that, Montmorency gave the first sign of contentment he had exhibited since we had started, and rolled over on his side and spread his legs out. And then I said, I bent my head back and bumped it against one of the hoops. But I didn't mind it. I didn't even swear. How good one feels when one is full. How satisfied with ourselves and with the world. Before our supper, Harris and George and I were quarrelsome and snappy and ill-tempered. After our supper, we sat and beamed on one another. And we beamed upon the dog, too. We loved each other. We loved everybody. We lit our pipes and sat, looking out on the quiet night, and talked. We got on to drains. And that put George in mind of a very funny thing that happened to his father once. He said his father was travelling with another fellow through Wales, and one night they stopped at a little inn where there were some other fellows, and they joined the other fellows and spent the evening with them. They had a very jolly evening and sat up late, and by the time they came to go to bed, they were slightly jolly too. They, George's father and George's father's friend, were to sleep in the same room but in different beds. Well, the candle lurched up against the wall when they got into the room and went out. And they had to undress and grope into bed in the dark. This they did, but instead of getting into separate beds, as they thought they were doing, they both climbed into the same one without knowing it. One getting in with his head at the top, and the other crawling in from the opposite side of the compass and lying with his feet on the pillow. There was silence for a moment. And then George's father said, "Joe, what's the matter, Tom?" replied Joe's voice from the other end of the bed. "Why, there's a man in my bed," said George's father. "Here's his feet on my pillow." "Well, it's an extraordinary thing, Tom," answered the other, "but I'm blessed if there isn't a man in my bed too." "What you going to do?" asked George's father. "Well, I'm going to chuck him out," replied Joe. "So am I," said George's father valiantly. There was a brief struggle, followed by two heavy bumps on the floor, and then a rather doleful voice said, "I say, Tom, how have you got on?" "I tell you the truth, my man's chucked me out." "So is mine. I say, I don't think much of this inn, do you?" We turned in at 10 that night, and I thought I should sleep well being tired, but I didn't. As a rule, I undress and put my head on the pillow, and then somebody bangs at the door and says it's 8:30. But tonight, everything seemed against me. The novelty of it all, the hardness of the boat, the cramped position. I was lying with my feet under one seat and my head on another. The sound of the lapping water round the boat and the wind among the branches kept me restless and disturbed. I did get to sleep for a few hours, and then some part of the boat which seemed to have grown up in the night kept digging into my spine. I woke at 6 the next morning and found George awake too. We both turned round and tried to go to sleep again, but we couldn't. So I set to work to wake up Harris with a skull. The third prod did it, and he turned over on his side and said he would be down in a minute. We soon let him know where he was, however. Then we pulled up the candles and looked down at the water and shivered. The idea had been that we should get up early in the morning, fling off our rugs and shawls, and throwing back the canvas, spring into the river with a joyous shout and revel in a long, delicious swim. Somehow, now the morning had come, the notion seemed less tempting. The water looked damp, chilly. The wind felt cold. I decided to compromise matters by going down to the edge and just throwing the water over myself. So I took a towel and crept out on the bank and wormed my way along to the branch of a tree that dipped down into the water. It was bitterly cold. The wind cut like a knife. I thought I wouldn't throw the water over myself after all. I would go back into the boat and dress, and I turned to do so. And as I turned, the silly branch gave way. and I and the towel went in together with a tremendous splash. And I was out midstream with a gallon of Thames water inside me before I knew what had happened.
By Jove, old Jay's gone in.
I heard Harris say as I came blowing to the service,
I didn't think he'd have the pluck to do it, did you?
Is it all right?
Sang out George.
Lovely, I sputtered back. Why don't you try it? Only wants a little determination.
But I couldn't persuade them.
I was very cold when I got back into the boat, and in my hurry to get my shirt on, I accidentally jerked it into the water. It made me awfully wild, especially as George burst out laughing. I couldn't see anything to laugh at, and I told George so, and he only laughed the more. I never saw a man laugh so much. I quite lost my temper with him, but he only roared the louder. And then, just as I was landing the shirt, I noticed that it was not my shirt at all. But George's, which I'd mistaken for mine. Whereupon the humour of the thing struck me for the first time. And I began to laugh. And the more I looked from George's wet shirt to George roaring with laughter, the more I was amused. And I laughed so much that I had to let the shirt fall back into the water again. Aren't you going to get it out? Said George. I couldn't answer him at all for a while. I was laughing so. But at last I managed to joke out. I never saw a man's face change so suddenly in all my life. What? He yelled, springing up. You silly cuckoo, why can't you be more careful what you're doing? Why the deuce can't you go and dress on the bank? You're not fit to be in a boat, you're not. Give me the hitcher. I tried to make him see the fun of the thing. But he couldn't. George is very dense at seeing a joke sometimes. Harris proposed that we should have scrambled eggs for breakfast. He said he would cook them. It seemed, from his account, that he was very good at doing scrambled eggs. He was quite famous for them. People who had once tasted his scrambled eggs never cared for any other food afterwards. But pined away and died when they couldn't get them. He had some trouble in breaking the eggs. Or rather, not so much trouble in breaking them exactly, as in getting them into the frying pan when broken, and keeping them off his trousers, and preventing them from running up his sleeve. But he fixed some half dozen into the pan at last, and then squatted down by the side of the stove and chivvied them about with a fork. But whenever he went near the pan, he burned himself. And then he'd drop everything and dance round the stove, flicking his fingers about and cursing the things. We didn't know what scrambled eggs were, and we fancied that it must be some Red Indian sort of dish that required dances and incantations for its proper cooking. The result was not altogether the success that Harris had anticipated. There seemed so little to show for the business. 6 eggs had gone into the frying pan, and all that came out was a teaspoonful of burnt mess. Harris said it was the fault of the frying pan. The sun had got more powerful by the time we had finished breakfast and the wind had dropped. And it was as lovely a morning as one could desire. Little was in sight to remind us of the 19th century. From Picnic Point to Old Windsor Lock is a delightful bit of the river. A shady road, dotted here and there with dainty little cottages, runs by the bank up to the Bells of Ouseley, a picturesque inn, as most upriver inns are, and a place where a very good glass of ale may be drunk. So Harris says. And on a matter of this kind, you can take Harris's word. Old Windsor is a famous spot in its way. Edward the Confessor had a palace here, and here the great Earl Godwin was proved guilty of having encompassed the death of the king's brother. Earl Godwin broke a piece of bread and held it in his hand. "If I am guilty," said the Earl, "may this bread choke me when I eat it." Then he put the bread into his mouth and swallowed it, and it choked him, and he died. We tugged steadily on to a little below Monkey Island, where we drew up and lunched. We tackled the cold beef for lunch, and then we found that we had forgotten to bring any mustard. I don't think I ever in my life, before or since, felt I wanted mustard as badly as I felt I wanted it then. I don't care for mustard as a rule, and it's very seldom that I take it at all, but I would have given worlds for it then. Harris said he'd have given worlds for mustard too. It would have been a good thing for anybody who had come up to that spot with a can of mustard then. He'd have been set up in worlds for the rest of his life. But there, I dare say both Harris and I would have tried to back out of the bargain after we had got the mustard. One makes these extravagant offers in moments of excitement, but of course, when one comes to think of it, one sees how absurdly out of proportion they are with the value of the required article. I heard a man going up a mountain in Switzerland once say he would give worlds for a glass of beer, and when he came to a little shanty where they kept it, he kicked up a most fearful row because they charged him 5 francs for a bottle of Bass. He said it was a scandalous imposition, and he wrote to the Times about it. He cast a gloom over the boat, there being no mustard. We ate our beef in silence. Existence seemed hollow and uninteresting. However, we brightened up a bit over the apple tart, and when George drew out a tin of pineapple from the bottom of the hamper and rolled it into the middle of the boat, we felt that life was worth living after all. We are very fond of pineapple. All three of us. We looked at the picture on the tin. We thought of the juice. We smiled at one another. Harry's got a spoon ready. Then we looked for the tin opener. We turned out everything in the hamper. We turned out the bags. We pulled up the boards at the bottom of the boat. We took everything out onto the bank and shook it. There was no tin opener to be found. Then Harris tried to open the tin with a pocket knife and broke the knife and cut himself badly. And George tried a pair of scissors, and the scissors flew up and nearly put his eye out. While they were dressing their wounds, I tried to make a hole in the thing with the spiky end of the hitcher. And the hitcher slipped and jerked me out between the boat and the bank into 2 feet of muddy water. And the tin rolled over. Uninjured. And broke a teacup. Then we all got mad. We took that tin out on the bank, and Harris went up into a field and got a big sharp stone, and I went back into the boat and brought out the mast, and George held the tin, and Harris held the sharp end of his stone against the top of it, and I took the mast and poised it high up in the air and gathered up all my strength and brought it down. We beat it out flat. We beat it back square. We battered it into every form known to geometry. But we couldn't make a hole in it. Then George went at it and knocked it into a shape so strange, so weird, so unearthly in its wild hideousness, that he got frightened and threw away the mast. Then we all three sat round it on the grass and looked at it. There was one great dent across the top that had the appearance of a mocking grin. And it drove us furious, so that Harris rushed at the thing and caught it up and flung it far into the middle of the river, and as it sank we hurled our curses at it, and we got into the boat and rowed away from the spot and never paused till we reached Maidenhead. Maidenhead itself is too snobby to be pleasant. We went through Maidenhead quickly and then eased up and took leisurely that grand reach beyond Bolters and Cookham Locks. Clifden Woods still wore their dainty dress of spring and rose up from the water's edge in one long harmony of blended shades of fairy green. In its unbroken loveliness, this is perhaps the sweetest stretch of all the river. We pulled up in the backwater just below Cookham and had tea, and when we were through the lock, it was evening. A stiffish breeze had sprung up, in our favour for a wonder. For, as a rule on the river, the wind is always dead against you, whatever way you go. We kept very quiet about it, got the sail up quickly before they found it out, and then we spread ourselves about the boat in thoughtful attitudes, and the sail bellied out and strained and grumbled at the mast, and the boat flew. I stared. There is no more thrilling sensation I know of than sailing. It comes as near to flying as man has got to yet. We had the river to ourselves, except that far in the distance we could see a fishing punt moored in midstream in which three fishermen sat. And we skimmed over the water and past the wooded banks, and no one spoke. We seemed like knights of some old legend, sailing across some mystic lake into the unknown realm of twilight. We didn't go into the realm of twilight. We went slap into that punt where those three old men were fishing. We didn't know what had happened at first, because the sail shut out the view. But from the nature of the language that rose up upon the evening air, we gathered that we had come into the neighbourhood of human beings, and that they were vexed and discontented. Harris let the sail down, and then we saw what had happened. We had knocked those three old gentlemen into a general heap at the bottom of the boat, and they were now slowly and painfully sorting themselves out from each other and picking fish off themselves. And as they worked, they cursed us. Not with a common cursory curse, but with long, carefully thought out, comprehensive curses that embraced the whole of our career and went away into the distant future, included all our relations, covered everything connected with us. Good, substantial curses. Harris told me we ought to be grateful for a little excitement, sitting there fishing all day. At Marlow, we left the boat by the bridge and went and put up for the night at the Crown. We got up tolerably early on the Monday morning and went for a bathe before breakfast. And coming back, Montmorency made an awful ass of himself. Halfway up the high street, a cat darted out from one of the houses in front of us and began to trot across the road. Montmorency gave a cry of joy, the cry of a stern warrior who sees his enemy given over to his hands, and flew after his prey. His victim was a large black tom. I never saw a larger cat, nor a more disreputable-looking cat. It had lost half its tail, one of its ears, and a fairly appreciable proportion of its nose. It was a long, sinewy-looking animal. It had a calm, contented air about it. Montmorency went for that poor cat at the rate of 20 miles an hour. But the cat didn't hurry up. Didn't seem to have grasped the idea that its life was in danger. It trotted quietly on until its would-be assassin was within a yard of it. Then it turned round and sat down in the middle of the road and looked at Montmorency with a gentle, inquiring expression that said, "Yeah. You want me?" Montmorency does not lack pluck. But there was something about the look of that cat that might have chilled the heart of the boldest dog. He stopped abruptly and looked back at Tom. Neither spoke, but the conversation was clearly as follows.
Can I do anything for you?
No, not at all. Certainly, don't trouble. I'm afraid I made a mistake. Yeah, I thought I knew you. Sorry I disturbed you.
Not at all. Quite a pleasure. You sure you don't want anything now?
No, not at all. Thanks, not at all. Very kind of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Then the cat rose and continued his trot. And Montmorency, fitting what he calls his tail carefully into its groove, came back to us and took up an unimportant position in the rear.
That episode of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome was adapted for radio and performed by Jeremy Nicholas. Incidental music was composed by Jeremy Nicholas and played by the Grimethorpe Colliery Band. Three Men in a Boat was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.